Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Newsflash, McCain ditches Palin and gets new running mate.
Joe the plumber.
These characters, you know, I don't have a last name. My name is Joe the...
Joe the plumber.
They thought Joe the plumber was dumb.
Okay, so Sarah Palin is still McCain's running mate. But at the debate last night, a real plumber named Joe Wurzelbacher became a central character in the saga of trying to illuminate the candidate's various tax plans. When you need a plumber to fix something, maybe you should ask yourself, what's the problem here? Pours through standing water. I'm John Huckenberry, live in Boston this morning. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Huckenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, I'm Adora Udoji, live in New York City. It's Thursday, October 16th. Morning, Hawk. And guess what? We're actually going to hear Joe the plumber speaking. He hails from Toledo, Ohio, so we'll hear what he thinks about all the ruckus.
It sounds like Joe Sixpack is a CEO. Good morning, Adora.
We're going to look at last night's debate where Joe the plumber came up, the issues and the temperaments of the candidates with the election just around the corner, the latest on the economy, and we're also going to take a look at evangelicals. Their vote probably depends on their race. Those stories are coming up, but first, these headlines.
Good morning, Adora. It is a debate-free zone from here on out. Barack Obama and John McCain had their final face-to-face matchup last night in New York. McCain went after Obama on his tax plan.
Why would you want to increase anybody's taxes right now? Why would you want to do that? Anyone in America.
Obama says most Americans won't get a tax increase, but business and people making a lot of money should pay more.
I think ExxonMobil, which made $12 billion record profits, over the last several quarters, they can afford to pay a little more so that ordinary families who are hurting out there, they're trying to figure out how they're going to afford food, how they're going to save for their kids' college education. They need a break.
And the campaigning goes on. McCain heads to Pennsylvania today, and he'll go for laughs as a guest on David Letterman's show tonight. Barack Obama is looking for votes in New Hampshire. While the candidates grabbed headlines, Asian markets were heading south. Major indexes were closed there, with Japan suffering most. The Nikkei plummeted 11.4%. Major European indexes are down 2 to 3%.
And the story was just as bad in New York yesterday. The Dow lost nearly 8% to close at 85.77. The S&P dropped 9%, settling at 9.07. And oil prices, they're at a 14-month low today, settling just above $74.50 a barrel in Asian trading.
Boy, a big difference from a couple of months ago. We'll have more on that.
That's
in
a
baseball,
fact. That's
the Philadelphia Phillies, well, they are going to head to the World Series.
Adora.
They
beat
the
Joe
LA
Torre
Dodgers
goes home
last night to win the National League title.
And they're on pins and needles up here in Boston, Adora, because tonight is maybe the last game of the series, the Tampa Bay Rays and the Boston Red Sox. The Red Sox are trailing the Rays 3-1. Game is tonight. That's what everyone's talking about here in Boston.
And since it was the last presidential debate last night, what are your final thoughts? How would you sum it up in a sentence? What did you take away from the two candidates, or nothing at all? If that's the case, we want to hear your story. 8778-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
What's your takeaway on the debates? That's our question.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. Responsibilityproject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Huckenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. In last night's third and final debate, presidential debate that is, Senator John McCain made one thing really clear.
Senator Obama, I am not President Bush. If you wanted to run against President Bush, you should have run 4 years ago.
Besides that, Barack Obama and John McCain discussed health care, the economy, abortion, and Bill Ayers. But the debate for many may have been even more about the temperament of the two men. Takeaway political director Andrea Bernstein was at Hofstra University on Long Island. Good morning, Andrea. And yesterday, it was yet another bad economic day. We saw the worst retail sales in 3 years, and the Dow plunged more than 700 points. But the candidates didn't spend that much time on the economy.
No, it was kind of surprising. Nobody sort of, you know, came out and kind of took it to have their FDR moment and talk about what the country needed to do and where to go much. I think there was about 22 minutes of talk about the economy. And McCain talking about his housing plan again, Obama getting more detailed, laying out a four-point plan. But most of the economic discussion was dominated by the name of Joe the Plumber, who is Joe Wurzelbacher from Toledo, Ohio, who had said that he was concerned that Obama's tax plan would raise taxes for a small business owner like him. And it sort of was making a central argument of the McCain campaign about Obama's taxes. Here's McCain.
What you want to do to Joe the Plumber and millions more like him is have their taxes increased and not be able to realize the American dream of owning their own business. That's what Joe believes.
He's been watching some ads of Senator McCain's. Let me tell you what I'm actually going to do. I think tax policy is a major difference between Senator McCain and myself. And we both want to cut taxes. The difference is who we want to cut taxes for.
So Joe the Plumber got a lot of airtime last night, I think.
If you were drinking shots on Joe the Plumber, you would be hammered.
Somewhere around 24 times his name was mentioned, I think.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, they both used it. I mean, Obama used it to say that his tax plan would give people like Joe the Plumber, small business owners, or people who wanted to start small businesses, much more help. He said it would help him with his health care plan. And, you know, then he turned around and said, oh, you know what McCain really wants to do is give Exxon a tax break. But every time they came to an economic theory, they came back to Joe the Plumber, to the point in the media file room, people began to giggle every time his name came up.
Let's go back to the sound we just heard where McCain was saying that he is not George Bush. That was the first time McCain took on that notion that Democrats have been hammering essentially for months, that a McCain administration would simply be an extension of the Bush administration. How did McCain say that he does differ from Bush?
Well, he clearly had his soundbite prepared on this, just as Obama had some of his prepared. And he was ready to go, and he has a list, and it's a fairly compelling list, except listen to what issue is not on this list.
It's very clear that I have disagreed with the Bush administration. I have disagreed with leaders of my own party. I got the scars to prove it. Whether it be bringing climate change to the floor of the Senate for the first time, whether it be opposition to spending and earmarks, whether it be the issue of torture, whether it be the conduct of the war in Iraq, which I vigorously opposed, whether it be on fighting the pharmaceutical companies, on Medicare prescription drugs importation, whether it be fighting for an HMO patient's bill of rights.
So not on that list were specific details of how his economic policy would be different from President Bush's.
Exactly. And after the debate, I asked Long Island Congressman Pete King, who was one of the key surrogates last night, well, what is the difference on the economy? And he paused a little bit and he said, deregulation. McCain favors more regulation. But, you know, clearly it wasn't even part of the talking points.
So it wasn't also interesting last night is that there were certainly some issues the two candidates did not discuss, immigration being one of them. But they certainly spent a lot of time talking about Bill Ayers, which is something the McCain campaign has been lodging accusations about, Bill Ayers and his association with the Weather Underground, about his relationship with Barack Obama.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, I mean, it's very important, clearly, in 2008 to be talking about the Weather Underground. Who'd have thought the Weather Underground would be such a big issue now today, but pivotal.
A bit of nostalgia for me.
In this debate. And but the way it came up was interesting because, you know, there have been all this sort of posturing beforehand and, you know, is McCain going to raise it and, is you know, what's going to happen? And guess who raised it? Obama. And it was very interesting because it came in this context of Bob Schieffer, the moderator, asking about negative campaigning. And John McCain starts talking about Congressman John Lewis of Georgia, who said that over the weekend he likened the McCain-Palin, some some of the things that have happened on the stump to George Wallace. And McCain, you know, stood up and he said, you know, this is very insulting. That was one of the worst moments in history. And how could you say this? How could he say this? And you never even, speaking to Obama, repudiated Congressman Lewis. And so listen to what Obama says. He talks about Congressman Lewis, and then he pivots to his own issue.
I mean, if we want to talk about Congressman Lewis, who is an American hero, he, unprompted by my campaign, without my campaign's awareness, made a statement that he was troubled with what he was hearing at some of the rallies that your running mate was holding, in which all the public reports indicated were shouting, when my name came up, things like terrorist and kill him. And that your running mate didn't mention, didn't stop, didn't say, hold on a second, that's kind of out of line.
And how did McCain respond to that?
Well, I mean, then all of a sudden we're talking about Bill Ayers because it's Obama that raises the T word, terrorist. And, you know, what happens is people think Bill Ayers, terrorist, Osama bin Laden, they're calling him, as we heard yesterday, they're calling Obama a Muslim. I mean, all of this stuff gets mixed together in people's minds. And so, you know, what Obama says is, well, you know, this is somebody that I knew when, or that did these despicable acts when I was 8 and I met him and we were on a board together with a lot of other people, including some Republicans. So Obama got his opportunity to say what he wanted to say about Ayers. And I actually asked David Axelrod, the campaign manager, whether this was on purpose, whether Obama had raised it because he wanted to talk about it. And Axelrod didn't exactly say yes, but he didn't exactly say no. And what Obama did is was sort of use this, you know, issue to pivot and to remain incredibly disciplined on the issue that he wanted to talk about.
If I occasionally mistaken your policies for George Bush's policies, it's because on the core economic issues that matter to the American people, on tax policy, on energy policy, on spending priorities, you have been a vigorous supporter of President Bush. Now, you've shown independence, commendable independence, on some key issues like torture, for example, and I give you enormous credit for that. But when it comes to economic policies, essentially what you are proposing is 8 more years of the same thing.
Let's do a pivot of our own here, which is let's talk about the temperament of the two men. There's certainly been a lot said and written about the stark contrast between the two of them.
That's right. I mean, Obama was cool to the point of almost looking sleepy at points in the debate, and McCain was very hot. I mean, he looked angry. He looked almost as if he couldn't believe this guy who's a first-term senator is doing so well. And, you know, there were points at which you could just sort of hear McCain thinking, you know, how could this guy be here in this position like you can right here in this clip?
Well, you know, I admire so much Senator Obama's eloquence, and you really have to pay attention to words. He said, we will look at offshore drilling. Do you get that? Look at. We can offshore drill now. We've got to do it now. We will reduce the cost of a barrel of oil because we show the world that we have a supply of our own. It's doable. The technology is here, and we have to drill now.
So, you know, McCain, during the debate, and we were sort of doing this debate companion, all of us, and people were like, oh, he looks strong and he looks forceful. But, you know, again, when McCain got on his high horse, what it turns out the people watching the debate didn't like it. He comes off as strident. He comes off as harsh. Uh-huh. Obama comes off as the guy that's in command.
I don't know how much changed here. I mean, I have to say my only takeaway from this debate was that Bill Ayers is going to have the hugest book deal when this election is finally over.
Yes, I mean, you know, Bill Ayers certainly got almost as much airtime as Joe the Plumber in this debate. Yeah, I mean, I don't think this debate was terrifically enlightening. I didn't hear a lot of new economic policies. I saw a reiteration of their key differences about, you know, Obama talking about giving a tax break to the little guy and McCain saying, no, you have to give it to the big guy because that's how you create wealth in this country. And I heard McCain talking about his housing plan. But these are things we've heard before. And in terms of detailed reassurances or an attempt to say something like, you know, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, or have this big moment to sort of turn the country around, it didn't happen in this form of them sitting around this table at Hofstra University.
Andrea Bernstein, we're always thankful for you. She is our takeaway political director, and we're going to send her on the road. And John, I think perhaps my takeaway from the debate last night was I didn't realize that eloquence is a bad thing.
Yeah, right. Well, you got to aim for those seventh graders, I think we learned in our analysis of the debate.
And that's coming up
this morning.
Yeah, no, that's actually coming up. Yeah, we're going to talk about that.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Now that you've had time to sleep over the last presidential debate, what did you wake up thinking about it? What did you take away from it last night?
Yes, my name is Phil, and I'm here in Oklahoma. And I'm going to be voting McCain this year. I've listened to Obama, and he's got all these cute little one-liner answers for things, but he never really gives any depth.
No depth there for Obama. By that listener, what do you think? 877-8-MY-TAKE, or drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org. John?
And we are America's exit poll. We also want your stories of when you voted. There are early voting programs all over the United States, and we want to hear how you voted and what mattered to you and how you made up your mind. The stories are fascinating. We've been taking the pulse all throughout the campaign, and now that the polls are open, why not continue it? But joining us now is Steve Goldstein, London Bureau Chief at MarketWatch. He's joining us from London, and as we've been talking about all morning, markets yesterday had some very serious capitulation going on, and this morning in Asia, Tokyo's Nikkei plunged more than 11%, its biggest drop since the 1987 stock market crash. Steve, it's always been the case that market declines are a leading indicator of a global recession, and that was a lot of the talk yesterday. But I'm wondering if you could sort out what proportion of these sell-offs is related to betting on the next 3 years regarding global economic growth, and what is basically just people cashing out of a sense of redemption and desperation.
Well, I wish I could tell you the precise answer to that. There's clearly some money going to the sidelines. We're seeing redemptions from mutual fund companies. We're seeing redemptions from hedge funds. Of course, the hedge funds have tougher rules about investors getting their money out. And the selling is pretty broad-based, we've been paying attention to the banks, of course, but from global mining companies to consumer-oriented companies. And a lot of it, we saw, particularly here in London, that these global miners, which are really a play on China and India economic growth, they're getting sold off very, very steeply, which indicates that that's really more of a recession play.
That's a recession play. I mean, copper going down, Billiton there, a big stock taking a giant hit in London this morning. But I imagine your job has changed a little bit as a market reporter in the sense that a lot of the work that you and some others are doing, and even on the trading floors are doing, is chasing some of these rumors that people are having difficulty with margin calls, or people are having difficulty making redemptions work, that there's a run on certain kinds of hedge funds. How much of your day is occupied with trying to confirm or dispel some of those rumors?
Well, I mean, we do have a lot of this rumor chasing, and it obviously doesn't make our job any fun, but that's part of reporting on the market. Before, what we had to do is chase rumors about merger deals, and of course we don't have that anymore. These things tend to even out. But it is true. I mean, I think that last week the classic example was Morgan Stanley, when there was the big sell-off, and was that deal going to go through with the Japanese lender and Mitsubishi, and it did eventually. But there were a lot of rumors about that. So you're right. We start seeing a big move, and then we're wondering, well, what is the story here? Is it just people worried about their future earnings, or is there something more serious going on?
You know, speaking of rumors, Steve, I was talking with a commodities trader earlier today, and he was saying that part of the issue on the sharp decline of copper and some other commodities is that, you know, ships full of commodities are simply parked. That there is a lot of commodity trading that's just stopped as people are anticipating that growth is just going to grind to a halt on a lot of these basic industries. Are you seeing anything like that?
Well, there's a key index. It's called the Baltic Dry Shipping Index. And that's one of the popular ways of measuring this. And it's falling off the cliff. I think that observation is right on target. You know, we saw Rio Tinto yesterday saying that they were going to cut back in terms of capacity. And really, you know, this is one of the world's most important mining companies, and they're just not seeing demand out there.
And they were also at record highs just a few months ago, Rio Tinto and some of the others, correct?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, they had tremendous runs, you know, coming into the first half of the year.
And what is that index again? The Baltic Dry Shipping
Index? The Baltic Dry Shipping Index. Not quite as catchy as Dow Jones Industrial Average.
Steve, I'm loving that. I'm loving it. It means, I mean, the people listening to The Takeaway are getting such a high grade of economic information. The Baltic Dry Shipping Index. Steve, thanks so much for identifying that for me.
No problems.
Steve Goldstein is the London Bureau Chief at MarketWatch. He joined us from London. There you go, Dora, the Baltic Dry Shipping Index. Huh?
He just unlocked so many doors for me with that, John. You have no idea.
And now we've got more doors to be unlocked by Femi Oke with the headlines. Femi, are you there?
I am here. Hello. Good morning to you, John. It's just coming out to 28 minutes past the hour. We have been talking a lot about Joe Wurzelbacher from Ohio with Andrea Bernstein and all of our political team. He made a few appearances in the debate last night. Joe has never met Senator McCain, but he did tell CBS last night how he came to meet Senator Obama.
And Obama came to my neighborhood. My son and I were outside tossing the football, and all of a sudden he showed up, and there went our football tossing for a while. And, you know, neighbors were outside asking him questions, and I didn't think they were asking him tough enough questions. So I thought, you know, I'll go over there. You know, I've always wanted to ask one of these guys a question and really corner him and get him to answer a question for once instead of tap dancing around it. And unfortunately, I asked the question, but I still got a tap dance.
That's Joe.
Whenever a plumber shows up, Femi, people get depressed.
Yeah, do you think so?
It's a total downer, yeah.
Yeah, really. That's Joe Wurzelbacher, a plumber from Holland, Ohio, otherwise known as Joe the Plumber. He has a bit of a backstory there, as you can tell. Futures for the Dow and S&P appear flat before the open today. Investors may be taking in this morning's announcement that investment bank Merrill Lynch posted a net loss of $5.1 billion. Shares plummeted in Asia today. Japan's Nikkei index closed down more than 11%. And though it's still a Category 3 storm, Hurricane Omar is weakening. Winds are decreasing and a hurricane warning for the U.S. Virgin Islands has been discontinued. Azerbaijan's current president won re-election yesterday with almost 90% of the vote. Opposing political groups refused to participate in the election, calling it neither free or fair. And the current administration is generally supported by the West, even though it's known for brutally strangling political opposition. And finally, we go to some sports in baseball. The Phillies are in the World Series. The team won 5-1 last night over LA, clinching the National League title in five games. And they're face off against the winner of the Rays-Red Sox series. Tampa Bay is up 3-1. That's a look at your news for now.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
We have to change the culture of America. Those of us who are proudly pro-life understand that. And it's got to be courage and compassion that we show to a young woman who's facing this terribly difficult decision.
Last night was the very first time abortion came up in the three presidential debates that have taken place, a development worth noting because the issue is so important to evangelicals who have been some of the most reliable Republican voters. This election, we've talked about how the evangelical vote may not be driven this time around by one or two social issues. That's particularly true between white and black evangelicals who share religious beliefs, but who vote on opposite sides of the spectrum. For more, we welcome back Randall Balmer, a professor of American religious history at Columbia University.
Thank you.
And Lisa Sharon Harper, the executive director of New York Faith and Justice.
Thank you.
Glad to have both of you here. Mm-hmm. So the first time, here we have three debates. In the middle of the very last debate, the issue of abortion and the Supreme Court comes up. Randall, what do you make of that?
Well, I think the abortion discussion, or what passes for debate in this country over abortion, is really getting a bit tired. The two sides are so entrenched that there's no meaningful discussion. And I've been advocating for a long time changing the terms of the discussion and addressing the issue of abortion as a legal issue and then also as a separable moral issue. I think that would bring clarity to the discussion. And we just haven't had that level of discussion. And I think a lot of people are just getting tired of it. Not that it's not an important issue on both sides of the matter for a lot of folks, but they're just getting tired of these abortion wars. And as I pointed out, I hate to repeat myself on Monday from the Monday program, but by my calculation from February 1st, 2006, when Samuel Alito was sworn onto the Supreme Court until January 3rd, 2007, when the new Democratic majorities took control of Congress, the Republican Religious Right Coalition controlled all three branches of the federal government. And yet, during that time, they made no effort whatsoever to outlaw abortion, their stated goal.
That's an interesting topic, and maybe we'll have you come back and talk about that. Well, Lisa, what do you make of it? It's sort of late in the 11th hour coming up.
Yeah, I think actually I would agree, but I would also think there's another way that this has gone down. If you were to divide this by race, by white evangelicals and black evangelicals, what you would find is that for black evangelicals, the abortion issue is fundamentally about poverty. You know, the higher the poverty rate in a community, the higher the abortion rate will be in that community.
Absolutely.
You know, and so if our main strategy was to overturn the conservative court, make it a conservative court, what you would find is that those judges vote against our well-being as black evangelicals. For example, they voted for de facto segregation just recently in schools, and they also consistently vote against affirmative action. Our strategy is to address abortion head-on by addressing the issue of poverty. So like programs like TANF or WIC, they work to give women the ability to choose.
You're talking about social welfare programs. But you go mm-hmm. right to the heart of the discussion, which is both black and white evangelicals, both are against abortion.
Oh,
they
absolutely.
They fundamentally agree on that point. However, in this election, once again, you see the vast majority of African-American evangelicals mm-hmm. supporting the pro-choice candidate, this time Barack Obama.
That's right. And they do that because they know that if they were to vote according to the religious right way of looking at abortion, they would actually be voting against themselves.
So what's the matter with Kansas kind of issue? Randall and Lisa, this is John Huckenberry up in Boston. And Randall, you actually made a bit of history on the program. You're the first guest to come in the same week to the studio in the morning. Thanks so much for joining us. I want to ask a question broadly. It's my impression, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the African-American evangelical constituency for the longest time was anti-Catholic fundamentally, and that changed in 1960. Randall, Lisa?
Well, that is true, and that characterization applies to the white evangelical community as well. As I was growing up as an evangelical evangelical household. I remember my parents telling me at one point that if I ever married a Catholic, that I would be disowned. And this was not an uncommon sentiment among evangelicals in the 1950s and 1960s. The 1960 campaign did indeed change that. In fact, I'm lecturing on that later today up at Columbia in my religion, the civil rights course. Mm-hmm. And the issue was the arrest of Martin Luther King in Atlanta during a sit-in at Rich's department store, and he was carted off to the penitentiary that night by cover of darkness. And Harris Wofford prevailed on the Democratic candidate, the Democratic nominee, John Kennedy, to make a phone call to Coretta Scott King, offering his support and his condolences, his sympathy.
It's a great story. We're actually having Harris Wofford on the show tomorrow.
Oh, but, good.
Lisa, I wonder if you, wonder if you have any insights into that shift that took place. Not so much the story of Martin Luther King, but this sort of broad dynamic of moving from a single issue anti-Catholic and maybe some other issues for African American evangelicals to something very, very different and much more socially astute, as you've already pointed out.
Yeah, well, I think it actually fundamentally has to do with the ways that evangelicals as a whole have been embracing a wider or broader understanding of what is the actual gospel, that the gospel is actually, or the good news of Scripture, is that God is actually restoring the relationships between all broken relationships that happened at the fall, between men and women and different races and us and God. And so, and because of that, we're coming closer to the Catholic value for justice and the Catholic value for anti-poverty work and things like that. So I think we're all finding reasons to join together and work together against poverty and for justice.
I'd really like to get to one central point that you talk about in your book, Lisa, and you also talk about, Randall, and that is white and black evangelicals fundamentally look at the way religion and their government affects their everyday lives. So when African Americans take a look at the world around them, tell us about some of the factors that drive them to the Democratic Party, although they don't necessarily represent their religious views.
That's really good. Well, I actually am really fascinated by the difference between these two groups and how they see patriotism, for example. Because patriotism, when white evangelicals look at it, they're thinking about the idea of America, apple pie, baseball, prosperity. But for African-American evangelicals, the main thing that comes up is the web of systems that actually make America, the education system, the health system, the penal system. And that America First theme, it actually, the way that they frame it, it makes it so that America can do no wrong. And black evangelicals understand that actually America has sinned and has never apologized for that. And, you know, we know that people of faith were the ones who actually led the abolitionist movement and led the suffrage movement and led the civil rights movement. It was not a benevolent nation acting out of its own inherent goodness. It was black evangelicals understand that patriotism
right.
is calling evangelicals, calling America to its best self.
Oh, we've sadly run out of time. So we're going to ask you back for a third time, Randall. Thank you both for joining us. Randall Balmer, Professor of American Religious History at Barnard College, and Lisa Sharon Harper, author of Evangelical Does Not Equal Republican or Democrat.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckenberry up here live at WDBH in Boston. Joining us now is Andrew Walker, who's the BBC economics correspondent. And as, if you listen to the program, you know that for the last several months, the BBC has been polling nations and communities around the world to get a sense of the impact of rising food and energy costs. The latest results have been published in time for World Food Day. Andrew Walker, what are the latest results?
Nearly two-thirds of people in this latest poll say that they're feeling the burden of recent rises in the cost of food and also energy. And there's particularly there's a marked divergence between the impact in rich and developing countries. Now, for example, there are four developing countries, the Philippines, Panama, Kenya and Nigeria, where people say they are, a majority of people say they are now eating less. The total of five developing countries where people, where again, a majority say that they've changed their diets. Now, that's not to say that the developed countries are not affected. They certainly are. For example, Australia, the UK, more than a quarter or more say that the rise in food prices has caused them to cut back. And US is also significantly affected, with a fifth or so saying that they've changed their diet.
One of the dynamics that you've noted repeatedly is the percentage of food costs in the developed world of the total family budget is radically different if you're in the developed world or the emerging markets. Can you see a sense in which this overall financial crisis is having an impact in the developed world versus the undeveloped world?
Well, I have to say, not really from this poll, because the field work on it was completed in September, of course, which, of course, was before the financial crisis really took hold. The general pattern so far, of course, is that the financial crisis has been more acutely felt in the rich countries, but there are certainly plenty of signs in financial markets of the contagion spreading to developing economies. So no doubt there will be an effect in due course. But as I say, it's not in the data in this poll.
Well, we're certainly going to see some very interesting patterns emerging in the next couple of months. Finally, energy prices beginning to decline. How do you think that's going to have an impact on the survey?
That also actually is, of course, true of food prices. There's some the energy prices and food prices in financial markets. The commodity markets have registered some quite large declines, a fall of about half now in the price of crude oil. And the Food and Agriculture Organization, a UN agency, has noted a 15% decline from the peaks in a kind of index that it does of overall food prices. So I have no doubt in due course that is going to be reflected in lower prices paid by consumers for food in the shops and at the markets. But, you know, even at current levels, food is still a lot more expensive than it was. And just taking that UN figure for wholesale food prices, they're still double what they were at the start of the decade. So, yes, prices will come down, but I'm sure they're going to remain a serious problem for many people, especially those on low incomes, for whom food, as you say, is sure, such a large part of their budget.
Yeah, well, there's a degree of uncertainty there. We're already seeing auto companies unable to take advantage of declining fuel prices because of other economic turmoil. Andrew Walker, as always, thanks for joining us. BBC economics correspondent Andrew Walker joining us from London on the BBC Food Price Global Survey.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, October 16th, and Femi Oke has just joined us. She's got some headlines. Good morning, Femi.
Hello there, Adora. It is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Three debates down and just 19 days to go before Election Day. Barack Obama and John McCain are both back on the trail after last night's final debate. They clashed on abortion, education, and of course how their economic policies will impact Ohio plumbers. In politics, they call Social Security the third rail. Touch it and your campaign gets a shock. But seniors will like the touch the government put on it today. Starting next year, Social Security payments are going up a full 5.5%. And that's the biggest boost in more than a quarter of a century. Another deadly medical helicopter crash, this time in Chicago. Four died when a chopper went down in the suburbs this morning. Investigators are on the scene right now, and this is at least the ninth fatal crash of a medical helicopter this year. And the Santa Ana winds are dying down, and that's very good news for the LA firefighters. Today's forecast has a light wind, which means an easier job getting flames under control. A 13,000-acre fire in the San Fernando Valley is now about 50% contained. Thousands of residents are being allowed home to take a look at the damage. Mike Gamula says it took just minutes for the flames to destroy his house.
It's amazing how for 5 years you can save and have things, and then 5 minutes, it's all gone.
And just that's heartbreaking. It is. Minutes, your house burns
down.
Yeah,
literally. And just very quickly, I just need to squeeze this in. Jobless claims drop more than expected to 461,000. And that's the latest news.
Thanks very much, Femi.
You're welcome.
Election day is less than 3 weeks away, and we want to hear what you're thinking about. Are you in one of those states where you've already voted, or are you still trying to figure out who you're going to vote for? Give us a call at 877-8-MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. On the line, we have Karen Strzelecki. She's from Madison, Georgia. She's already voted, and she's going to share her story. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Karen, tell me the moment where you were and what you were doing when you decided it became crystal clear to you, I should say, rather, on which candidate was the one for you.
It happened very early on. In fact, the very first time I saw Senator Obama give a speech, I was sitting in my living room watching television by myself, and I think my husband had already gone to bed, and I must have been flipping channels or something, and all of a sudden this interesting man was on the screen, and I thought, oh, who's this? And I listened to him, and it just almost within just moments, I thought, wow, where did this guy come from? And I listened, and just the emotion that welled up inside of me was unbelievable. And I've been a voter for many, many years. My first presidential election was Jimmy Carter's election, and I have voted in every election since. And this was the first time that I felt truly connected to a candidate who was running for president, and it just it literally brought tears to my eyes. I sat there and cried because I felt like here was a person who could really bring us all into the process. I truly felt the connection.
Was there something particular he said, or was it his overall message of change, which is what he's been talking about for months?
Right. Well, yes, I was interested in the change, but I felt like he just physically, literally, and figuratively represented a coming together of at least two groups in our country that I felt like should have come together a longer time ago than now, and certainly steps made through the civil rights movements in the 60s. But I just felt like he represented the best of everyone who could come together in one single person and bring this country out of the morass that it's in.
Karen, thank you so much for joining us this morning. We really appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome.
Karen Strzelecki, she is an Obama supporter who's already cast her ballot in Madison, Georgia, a state where McCain is leading. So we'll see what happens there. John?
Yeah, she did some of the early voting on September 22nd, I think, almost the first opportunity to vote. She voted down there in Georgia. And, yeah, she's really agonizing over her decision, it sounds like. Enough of this touchy-feely stuff about the election, though. And in the course of America's exit poll, we're also evaluating the debates. And if you listened to the debate last night, you heard something like this. Listen.
I don't think that Joe right now wants to pay a fine when he is seeing such difficult times in America's economy. Senator Obama wants to set up health care bureaucracies, take over the health care plan of America through, as he said, his object is a single payer system. If you like that, you'll love Canada and England. So
is
the
that
point
your objective?
It is not.
And I just described it. I just described what my plan is. And I'm happy to talk to you, Joe, too, if you're out there. Here's your fine. Zero.
Whether it's Joe the Plumber or Canada or England that you're talking about, that was the debate last night. Paul J.J. Payak joins us now. He's analyzed the language patterns of all the debates in a very scientific way. Paul, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here.
You got a pretty big text file to deal with. Quickly take us through how you do the analysis, and then I want to find out what you discovered.
Well, basically what we do is we look at the text from a
linguistic viewpoint. In other words, how many words are used, what's the choice of words, what's active versus passive voice, how long sentences are, things of that nature. And then what we do is we compile it, and interesting things always pop out when you just look at that. The idea is to look at it without political bias. It's just, what does the language tell us about what happened last night?
How well do they actually speak? And we should say that
how well do they speak? At what grade level do they speak? How easy is it to understand?
Let's talk grade level then. You already analyzed the Lincoln-Douglas debates from the 1800s, and Abraham Lincoln, I was kind of surprised to learn, spoke at only an 11th grade level.
That's actually very high in political discourse.
Really?
11th and 12th grade are very high grade levels. I mean, last night, Obama spoke at a 8.8 grade level, 8.8, and McCain spoke at 7.7.
Ooh, tough.
Now, that's in today's political discourse, that's actually right where you're targeting, because you want to be able to speak in short sentences that are to the point, et cetera. And so basically they came in where they usually do. McCain has been as low as third grade in his acceptance speech at the Republican nomination. And Obama's been higher, like in the 11th grade pattern. But recently he's been trying to be more direct and speak directly to the people, and he's been lowering his grade pattern.
Well, it's interesting how you watch it bounce around there, depending on what the aims of the candidate happen to be at any given moment. How have you fared analyzing Palin and Biden?
Well, Palin and Biden, that was pretty controversial, because Palin actually spoke at a higher grade level, about a 10th grade level, and Biden was at a 9th grade level. And that's caused a lot of concern, because people didn't really understand. It didn't mean that Palin won the debate. It meant that she spoke in more complex sentences, which also means it can be harder to understand. Now, historically,
won the debate. Forget that. I mean,
you say it's a higher grade level, and people think, like, well, does that mean you win? And in politics, the answer is no. Actually, the lower grade level is better. But the interesting thing here yet last night was that two things stood out from the linguistic analysis. One is that Obama usually speaks between 2 and 3% of his words are passive, okay, which means that there's not a doer to the action, okay. And in political speechifying, passive voice is usually looked upon as not as good as active voice, which has a doer of the action, is very direct, etc. And last night he spoke at double the passive rate that he usually speaks at. That was interesting. The other thing that stood out as we did this analysis was in a clip you just played, how many times he used the word I. Now, this was just kind of interesting, and we're going through the analysis, looking at all the words that he used, et cetera, thinking about Joe the Plumber, you know, thinking about all these great lines and all, and yet the word I came out 158 times on Obama's side. He used the word I 158 times, which is about pretty high for even for a politician. McCain, on the other hand, used it 119 times. So it was kind of interesting that two things stood out. One is that linguistically he did a very good job, but he had a lot higher passive voice than normal, double McCain and double what he usually uses, and then he also used the word I so many more times.
That's really interesting stuff. You're also looking at pacing and some other things that take place in the debate.
All sorts of things.
Well, J.J. Payak, President and Chief Word Analyst of the Global Language Monitor. He spoke with us from Austin, Texas, saying that Sarah Palin is closer to Abraham Lincoln than Joe Biden. We are always on at The Takeaway, and last night was the final round between McCain and Obama. What did you take away from the debate? Did anything surprise you or confuse you or change your mind?
Audrey Bocaraton, Florida. They spoke about a lot of things in the debate. I made up my mind. This was, the nail that closed the box. I decided that I'm not going to vote. I'm not going to vote for either one of them.
What do you think at 877-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org?
That's interesting, because we've heard that several times today, John. People have decided not to vote as a result of the presidential debates. Unusual.
They've decided to be undecided. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
This is The Takeaway.
So, MIT researcher Benjamin Mako-Hill, good morning.
Good morning.
You watched the debate last night as a scientist?
Absolutely, yes.
I mean, there was a lot of back and forth. There's this business of Joe the plumber. You must have heard that, right?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
You know, and now, at the end of the debate, there were all these campaign people declaring victory and pundits. They were doing the same thing. There were even those people meters from some of the cable channels showing, I don't really know what, but did you check any of that?
Oh, sure, yeah. I checked it out.
So I guess, you know, you're from MIT. I'm wondering if there is some actual definitive, ironclad, fully technological way of knowing who won that debate last night.
Well, of course, absolutely. I, of course, have been running the numbers all night.
You've been running the numbers all night?
Oh, sure, yeah, yeah.
So can you tell me?
Well, no, that's proprietary information.
The 21st century. What good is it? Live from Boston, it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. I'm Adora Udoji, live from New York City. It's Thursday, October 16th. And morning, Hock.
Morning. Our audience is going to meet Mako-Hill.
I know.
Your friend and mine.
They're in for such a treat. We're looking forward to that. Today, it's the morning after the last presidential debate before Election Day. We have reports from two potential swing states, Indiana and North Carolina, on how undecided voters are feeling there. We also take a look at the growing accusations of voter fraud and illegal voter roll purging. And remember those days when oil was $147 a barrel? Today, it's half that. Those stories coming up. First, these headlines.
Those were the good old days. Some fresh economic data at this hour. U.S. markets will be chewing over it in a few minutes. Consumer prices are flat, driven down by decreases in costs for gas and clothing. Also, jobless claims have slipped just a bit. Asian indices closed way down, though. Japan's Nikkei got the worst beating, sinking 11.4%.
And John McCain and Barack Obama today are back on the campaign trio. In last night's final matchup, the exchanges were sharp, and so were the metaphors. Asked how they would attack the ballooning budget deficit, talk turned to fiscal cutlery. Barack Obama supports targeted reductions.
Across-the-board spending freeze is a hatchet, and we do need a scalpel, because there's some programs that don't work at all. There's some programs that are underfunded.
McCain supports a government-wide freeze on spending. He said there's room for more than one blade in the budget drawer.
Of course we can take a hatchet and a scalpel to this budget. It's completely out of control.
Barack Obama is in New Hampshire today. John McCain visits Pennsylvania. He's also a guest on Letterman tonight. John?
Well, whoever wins the White House inherits a very heavy job. President Bush talked about the conservative outrage over buying shares of private banks. Listen.
It's necessary that the stock be purchased to help us through this financial crisis. But in the long run, it's not good for the country. And so the plan is structured to get government in a position where these investments will be returned to the taxpayers.
In sports, baseball's World Series matchup is taking shape, at least half of it. The Phillies are in the series. Boston and Tampa Bay, we'll just have to see. That game is tonight.
And our question today to you is the final debate between McCain and Obama. What did you take away from it? What are you thinking today about the candidates? Have you changed your mind or have you made a decision? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. In this historic election, there are all kinds of interesting ways of measuring or interesting questions that need to be measured. And all our from the Center for Future Civic Media here at MIT, Benjamin Mako Hill will be with us. And there's lots to measure and lots to think about. But also joining us for this segment is Catherine Welch, news director of WHQR in Wilmington, North Carolina, and Micah Schweitzer, who's a reporter from WNIN Radio in Evansville, Indiana. We wanted to welcome both of you to the program today to take the pulse of states in which things are in flux politically in ways that are very, very surprising. Catherine and Micah, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, both of you were watching the debate last night and were hanging out with voters, correct?
Yes.
Well, let's begin in Evansville, Indiana, if we could. I think this is Evansville, Indiana. Yes. This is someone named Sherman Stevens that you talked with, Micah. We're going to listen to this, and then I want to hear your reaction to what he had to say. Listen.
Well, again, they're both polished politicians, but I would think Obama was very, very informative, more so than McCain was, on areas like education. He was a little bit more, again, McCain was good, but Obama was just a little bit better on it. A more polished speaker, as I mentioned before, that he's like Clinton, he could sell a bridge in the desert.
That's a good line. Micah, tell me about Sherman Stevens.
Well, Sherman Stevens is a 71-year-old retired member of the U.S. Marine Corps. He's a lifelong independent voter. And here's a voter who's not sold on either candidate, looking for answers to an issue that's faded from the campaigns. He came to the debate specifically looking to hear what the candidates had to say about border issues, illegal immigration, and NAFTA. And he was very dissatisfied with the cursory glance that was tossed in that direction. And as a result, he decided after the debate that he was not going to vote for either Obama or McCain. He is, in fact, now going to cast his vote for Libertarian Bob Barr.
Now, Micah, in some ways, that probably doesn't reflect the broad view of people in Evansville, Indiana. But one thing that is reflected in what Sherman was saying is something that we've been told all campaign long by our takeaway political director, Andrea Bernstein, that people are really hungry for issues and are willing to take a look at any candidate, regardless of party, if they address the issues head on. Is that what you're finding in Indiana?
That is what I'm finding. Of course, the economy is the number one issue here, as it is in so many places. But Sherman Stevens is a good example that people want to hear about some other issues as well. In Mr. Stevens' case, it's immigration. And some of these issues are not playing out on the campaign like we thought they might have a year ago. And so he is indicative of people wanting to hear about the issues. But he's also indicative of the fact that a lot of people who are undecided for negative reasons. They're not undecided because they like both candidates so much. They're undecided because they don't like either candidate.
Well, Catherine Welch, I want to get you in here. Both campaigns are saying that North Carolina is actually in play, which I think is certainly a surprise right off the bat. First of all, Catherine, listen to this voice that you actually obtained for us from North Carolina, and then I want to talk about who this person is. Listen.
McCain, I think, focused a little bit too much on Joe the Plumber. You know, it's important to be able to take a political concept and focus that in on a specific example, but, you know, you don't want to focus on that to the exclusion of possibly things that are as deserving or more so of coverage and airtime.
There's another individual jumping on an issue. Who was that, Catherine?
That was John DeMalis, and he was sitting at a bar in a southern cooking bistro that was holding a debate party, and he works in IT at GE Nuclear, which has its world headquarters here in Wilmington. He says he's an undecided voter, and I said, well, how can you know, so many people have made up their mind, so many people I've talked to here in North Carolina. He said, well, you know, I'm a scientist, and I like to gather all the facts and parse them out. He's keeping spreadsheets, and he's going to do a little more truth squatting and says he's not going to make up his mind until 3 days before the election.
Catherine, question for you. Do you think the state is so close because of demographic issues, or is it all about Obama, a great attraction for some voters there in North Carolina? Because there is a general surprise that North Carolina is polling so evenly between the two.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. I think the latest off pollster.com has Obama at 47.9% and McCain at 47.2%. I think it's part of each. There, of course, has been a huge urban influx in what's called the Research Triangle, which is the Raleigh-Durham-Chapel Hill area, a lot of biotech jobs there. So there's a lot of influx there. Charlotte has grown as a banking capital. And in our part of the state that is along the ocean, there's sort of an influx of young and new, a lot of retirees from up north. And, of course, it depends on how they have grown up in their voting patterns. But we're also getting a lot of new industry like GE Nuclear. We have a pharmaceutical company here, and we're getting those young workers here. So you have that influence. But then at the same time, we had a primary in May that was up for grabs, and the Obama campaign has been on the street, has been in barbershops, restaurants, on college campuses. I work not far from a college campus, and they literally grab people, students, before they go in. Hey, have you registered to vote yet? And this has been happening since April and really hasn't let up. The Obama campaign has been here on the streets working the neighborhoods, and has to factor into it.
Sure, and let's not forget, you know, the senator, John Edwards, was, you know, one of the candidates there. So a lot of unpredictability, a lot in play. Micah, you know, and we're relying on both of you because public radio reporters are really spending a lot of time interacting with voices. You're our eyes and ears in some of these really interesting battleground communities. Micah, why is Indiana seemingly in play in some sense?
Well, Indiana is, like a lot of the surrounding Midwestern states, an industrial center and one that is deeply affected by the economy. And Indiana has voters who are concerned about the economy. And so as the economy has become a progressively more prevalent issue in the race, we see that that is helping Barack Obama because, like Mr. Stevens last night, other undecided voters I've spoken with do give Obama some points on his handling of economic issues and prefer him on domestic policy. So, you know, that's what's moving Indiana into this surprising position of being a toss-up state in 2008.
Well, you know, I guess, you know, you mentioned the economy there in North Carolina, Catherine. Wachovia is a big bank in Charlotte, North Carolina, that now, of course, is part of Wells Fargo. How do people in North Carolina, you know, what do they make of that?
That makes the economy hit home, a lot closer to home. There's a lot of eyes around the state looking at what's happening in Charlotte. And so we have one part of the state that's banking, like the Charlotte area, and then we have the coastal area that's heavily dependent on the tourist industry and the huge business heart of the state in the Raleigh-Durham Triangle area. So the economy was key, and everybody I talked to last night, there were two things on their mind, the economy and, interestingly enough, how Obama was going to respond to the personal attacks. So the economy certainly on the minds of folks around the state.
Micah, do you think that this election has changed the way people think about politics in general, that they think perhaps they have a different kind of a voice, that their engagement is more valuable in some sense? Or is this simply, you know, something driven by the candidates and, you know, something that we're not going to see as more of a tectonic shift in the way Indiana approaches politics from here on out?
It depends who you talk to. I mean, I've talked to, for instance, some young college voters, and they say that potentially they will be involved in future elections as well. There's no question that the candidates, in particular Barack Obama, are driving a lot of the interest that's going on. But people, I think, do feel like it's up to them to make some important decisions this fall. On the other hand, I've spoken to people who say that this is still politics as usual, who remain somewhat cynical about what either candidate can do once they enter office. So, you know, it really depends on who one talks to.
Well, it affects the cynicism factor, that's for sure. Catherine, quickly, tectonic shift or one-time event, do you think?
Good question. I think the question is going to be how many of these 600,000 new voters will vote again in 4 years. The George Bush won the state in 2004 by 12%. A lot of people think that these new voters can make a difference. Will they vote again? And that's the question to find out in 4 years.
The 2012 question is maybe the most interesting. Catherine Welch, news director for WHQR Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, and Micah Schweitzer, reporter for WNIN Radio in Evansville, Indiana. Thanks to both of you. And you'll find more tools on our website that look at the candidates in new ways. Look for a map of the counties that count and an updated and embeddable Electoral College prediction tracker, all on our election website, vote2008.thetakeaway.com.
Wait a second, John. You're very funny. 2012 is going to be a fascinating year. What about 2008?
Yeah.
What do you think? What do you think?
Well, I'm always looking ahead. You're on the takeaway. Always looking ahead.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
My takeaway from the debates is that we really just don't have a choice. And for the first time in my adult life, I think the debates have convinced me not to vote because neither one of these guys is good. If this is the best this country has to offer, egad, we are in desperate straits.
Desperate straits. What's your takeaway from the debate? We've been asking you all along, and we wanted to ask you about the final debate last night. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We've also been reminding you that the polls are open, and we are America's exit poll here at The Takeaway. People are voting in early voting programs all over America. In Chicago, you've been able to vote since the 13th of October. Brian Hinkle joins us. He's a 23-year-old voter in Chicago. Brian, you have voted, right?
Yes, I have. I just voted on Tuesday morning.
All right. What was it like? What did you do? What did they give you?
Well, keep in mind that I'm voting on the south side of Chicago. In fact, I live in the same neighborhood as Barack Obama in Hyde Park. So needless to say, there was significant interest in early voting. I had to wait in line 20 minutes. On the first day, the Cook County Election Board said that 15,000 people in the city of Chicago voted early. That's just on the first day. So very impressive turnout. And I think it speaks to something good about people's engagement with the election.
What made you decide to vote early, and what made you decide to vote for the candidate you voted for?
Well, as far as voting early, I'm actually going to be an election judge for Cook County this year. So it's either this or absentee, and frankly, I don't trust Chicago's mail system any further than I can throw it. So as far as voting...
You're a smart man, Mr. Hinkle. You're a smart man. And what made you decide on the candidate you voted for?
Well, I will be voting, or have voted, I should say, for John McCain and Sarah Palin. It was a long journey. It started with me supporting Mitt Romney in the Republican primary several months ago. But I've seen John McCain start to grow from the more radical and more angry personage he had as a Senate personality. And he's grown to moderate himself in his relationship with the base. And it was really his choice of Sarah that clinched it for me.
All right, Brian. Well, thanks so much. 23-year-old voter in Chicago. Imagine Brian Hinkle standing in a line on the south side of Chicago in Barack Obama's neighborhood waiting to vote for John McCain. He did. It's America's Exit Poll. We want your stories of making up your mind and how you voted early at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
That's so interesting, John. Lines in Illinois, and we heard last week lines in Georgia for early voting. But let's get back to the presidential debate last night. Did you hear this?
We need to know the full extent of Senator Obama's relationship with Acorn, who is now on the verge of maybe perpetrating one of the greatest frauds in voter history in this country, maybe destroying a fabric of democracy.
It's a pretty strong statement, destroying the fabric of democracy. There are indeed growing accusations from both Republicans and Democrats about voter fraud and illegal purging of voter rolls, as well as lawsuits. Perhaps not surprising in an election year with so many close races and often confusing rules about identification needed to vote. And there's also the record-breaking registration blocks. Already, the federal court, or at least several federal courts, are weighing in. Joining us now is Adam Skaggs, a lawyer with the nonprofit Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law. Good morning, Adam, and welcome.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Let's start with the nonprofit group ACORN. We've been hearing a lot about accusations that they have been conducting voter registration fraud. You want to explain that?
Well, there has been a lot of accusations, and I think they need to be taken with a grain of salt. You heard Senator McCain last night say that they were threatening to tear the very fabric of democracy. And in fact, this morning, Governor Crist, Charlie Crist, a Republican governor of Florida, has actually come out and say, you know what, these are really getting out of control. These have been completely exaggerated. He's in the Miami Herald making that observation. So I think folks need to realize that these are being hyped for the purposes of partisan advantage. Fraud is being invoked in order to justify a number of different measures that are going to have the effect of suppressing voter turnout.
But what about those who say, look, we need to make sure that our voter registration lists are credible and that there were names on some of the lists that ACORN turned in of people that don't exist? In fact, Mickey Mouse was on one of those lists. How do you respond?
Well, I respond by agreeing with what they say. I think it's important that our voter registration rolls are accurate, and I think probably every American would agree with that. I think it's important to realize first that the odds of Mickey Mouse showing up at the poll and casting a vote are pretty low in this country, not only because for the obvious reasons, but also because federal law requires that a new registrant, like Mickey Mouse, can't be allowed to vote a regular ballot until he shows ID. Now, the odds that somebody is going to register as Mickey Mouse, get a fake ID, get a fake driver's license, and then show up at the polls, I think folks would agree, are pretty low. But I think this whole distraction with ACORN is really just a diversion from the real issue, which is that millions of Americans are not on the registration rolls. They're not going to be able to vote in this election because of a number of different measures and laws in various states that prevent people from getting on the rolls and staying there.
Give us an example.
Well, I think one of the most timely examples is what's happening in Ohio right now. In Ohio, the Republican Party sued a couple weeks ago, and they said that voters that had not been successfully matched against either the Social Security or the motor vehicle database should be challenged and either should be kicked off the rolls.
And essentially, the circuit court in Ohio has now ordered the Secretary of State of Ohio, who is a Democrat, to go back through the voter lists and verify that they are accurate, correct?
Well, that's basically accurate. The circuit court has ordered the secretary to provide a list to all the counties of whatever voters were not matched. Now, keep in mind this database matching that's conducted is an inherently flawed exercise. It fails all the time. It fails all the time for reasons that have nothing to do with voter eligibility. Typos, data entry errors made by government clerks when they process registration forms, existing problems in the motor vehicle database, different treatment of hyphenated last names, that sort of thing, use of a married name in one database and a maiden name in another. So these have nothing to do with voter eligibility, but they prevent these matches from taking place all the time.
Very quick last question. Do you anticipate that there are going to be a slew of lawsuits as we march to November 4th and voting day?
Well, I think history teaches that that's probably pretty likely. There are already a number of lawsuits. And in Ohio, this matching problem we talked about threatens the ability to vote of more than 200,000 voters in Ohio. That's about one-third of every new voter to register this year. So let's watch that.
And that's important because we know that President Bush won the state by around 160,000 votes. Adam Skaggs, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Adam Skaggs is a lawyer at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law. And, John, we didn't get to the point that there's never been any evidence of fraud influencing the end result of an election.
That's right. That's right. The claims are exaggerated if you look at the outcome of actual elections.
Mm-hmm.
Last night was your last chance to see McCain and Obama debate. What did you take away?
This is Hector Cohen from Manhattan. I'm curious why we're always talking about Joe Sixpack and Joe this. I mean, why don't we talk about, for example, Hector or Jose, you know, the same people that vote that have different takes and we're from different areas. And, you know, there's, for example, Hector, the finance guy.
What impressed you? What surprised you? 877-8 my take or my take at thetakeaway.org. Quickly, industrial production is down almost 3%. That's the most since 1974. And it apparently reflects hurricane activity. That's the latest.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. A couple of economic details before we continue our discussion on the election. Unlike yesterday, the Wall Street markets are open flat or marginally positive in the early going after a dreadful loss yesterday. Of course, Asian markets were down very, very severely today. Adora, I know that you're jealous of me up here at WGBH
in
Boston.
I am jealous.
And it has nothing to do with the baseball playoffs. It's because I'm here with Benjamin Mako Hill, who's a fellow at MIT's Center for Future Civic Media. Mako, thanks so much for coming into the studio.
Great to be here, yeah.
You know, we've already heard in the show, okay, a story of reporters from states where people are in play and they're attempting to track the movement of voters who were in one party and maybe are moving to somewhere else. Legal challenges for voter registration lists, the technology of which seems to be well into the, like, 17th century rather than the 21st. I want to begin by just asking you, as far as a Center for Future Civic Media is concerned, this has to be a pretty important moment to be thinking about such issues.
That's absolutely true. It's also I think interesting because we talk about sort of civic technology and civic things all the time, but the most exciting thing is that lots of other people seem to care right now because people are thinking about the election.
And the fact that people get engaged suddenly creates all kinds of opportunities for you to test democracy in ways that we can't really even understand yet, and that a lot of your work will actually be giving us some really interesting insights and windows. Let's talk, for instance, about the presentation you made to our staff a few months back about your Selectricity project, which is a really interesting, different way of thinking about elections.
Sure, absolutely. So Selectricity is, it's sort of described as voting machinery for the masses. But the idea is that it's election technology. In fact, a lot of the best of election technology sort of put to use for everyday decision making. I think that, you know, there was actually a little exchange earlier about saying we've got all these new registered voters. Are they going to be here in 4 years? I think it's sort of, are they going to come back, be interested?
Right, right.
And I think it plays to this idea that when we think about elections and voting, we're almost entirely focused on government and state-based elections, right? And the result is that we think of, democracy as something that happens once every 4 years. So, like, this is from a technologist perspective, right? So, I mean, that's a little selfish of me, but that's how I think about it.
Well,
things.
You are from MIT,
that's right.
We'll forgive you.
That's
know.
Right. So from a technologist perspective, you can't help but notice that while there are, there's huge departments that are working on new election technologies, and as it turns out, governments are probably the least likely group to adopt any new election technology. So we have all sorts of technologies for helping people make better decisions. And the result is, the fact is that almost none of it's used ever.
And Selectricity is a tool for basically setting up elections as a way of establishing a preference, not a yes or no vote.
That's right. So in a very simple way, instead of just selecting one thing, people sort of can rank a set of candidates, and then using, better what are called election methods, right, better ways of counting votes, this Selectricity can choose from a series of different methods which allow people to select the candidate which sort of maximizes preference within the group. The idea is that if you have, let's say, a polarized electorate, nothing we know about, right, this can kind of disadvantage third-party candidates, as we see and as we know. And one result of this is that a compromise candidate may not have much of a chance, right? Even if they're the person that sort of would make everyone just as happy, they may not have the most number one votes and frequently don't.
Preferences, it's easier to enforce and see compromises come together, and people can do this on their own. That's what's so interesting.
That's right, absolutely. So people can, using Selectricity, you can go and create any election you want just in 30 seconds. And, people use it to decide meeting times. People use it to decide things that are actually look more like the types of elections that we're used to, like people have elected organizational boards of directors using it. But, really, the sky's the limit.
And so, Mako, essentially is what you get to is the thing that people are least likely to reject. Is that a good way of saying it?
I think that's right. I think that you'd say that I think that you have the one that sort of maximizes preference within the group, right? So I think that that's right. The one that makes most people the most happy.
But is that a way of enforcing cynicism where you, instead of like lesser of two evils, it's lesser of 12 evils?
I don't think I'd say that. But you'd say, I mean, I think that the problem is that the current system can't even choose the lesser of two evils. So actually choosing the one that makes most people the most happy, even if it doesn't make everyone, make anyone as happy as they possibly
Mako,
could be.
Give us an example, like a specific example.
Well, I mean, so an example would be, I mean, I guess.
Let's say you had a group of people and the choice was Indian food, Italian food, or Americano food. How would you set up electricity there?
So you'd go to Selectricity, you'd just create an election really quickly, you'd put in those three choices, and then people would be presented with a list. They would basically sort things in the list in the order of their preference. Now we might have a situation where half the people love Indian food but hate Americano food, and half the people love Americano food but hate Indian food. But the second choice, I don't recall what it was.
The third choice would then win out because it would be the compromise choice.
It would win out if we use a preferential
right,
method.
Right.
If we use a traditional sort of first past the post, which one has this number one?
Then we fight about lunch all afternoon long and nobody gets to eat. Right. That's the problem. Right. Final question before we go in this segment anyway. You're here for the rest of the hour. Where in civic media are people becoming more and more engaged? Where are people really reaching out to use tools and to get involved? Is it cell phone? Is it texting? Is it social aggregation communities like Facebook? Is it Selectricity?
So, I mean, I think that it's the combination. It's all of them, but it's also the combination of all of them, right? I mean, the reality is that we don't live our lives through our cell phones any more than we live them through Facebook. We use a combination of these tools, and the most important possibilities, I think, are actually places where you can have access to some of these tools from a variety of places and interact with them in a series of different ways.
And indeed, you've already seen the candidates and the campaigns attempting to reach everybody in all places at once. We're certainly going to know a lot about what civic media means at the end of this election, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
Well, Mako, stay with us. Mako Hill is a fellow at MIT's Center for Future Civic Media, and he's here with me live at WGBH. In Boston, and now live at WNYC in New York is Femi Okeh with
the
headlines.
Hey there, John. It's 20 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning, all. The Dow and S&P were mostly flat at the open today. Traders are busy feasting on a lot of fresh economic data just out this morning. The Fed reported today that industrial production plummeted 2.8% in September. That's the biggest drop in over 30 years. Disruptions caused by Hurricanes Ike and Gustav sparked the drop. The price of crude oil has dropped to around about $72 a barrel, and that makes the wholesale price of crude less than half of what it was just about 3 months ago. Thai and Cambodian military officials will jointly patrol a disputed region near the border to avoid conflicts while talks continue. This comes a day after fighting over land surrounding a 900-year-old temple near the border left two people dead. And it's still a Category 3 storm, but Hurricane Omar is weakening, winds are decreasing, and a hurricane warning for the U.S. Virgin Islands has been discontinued. That's a look at some of the stories making news this morning.
Many thanks, Fem.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Dora Udoji. Good morning. I'm Dora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
And I'm John Hockenberry, and markets on Wall Street are open and are not going to continue, apparently, the contagion of capitulation that's been taking place around the world in response to yesterday's drop in the market. But oil, no, that continues to drop. And we've seen oil go from being an indicator of the price of fuel to a weird commodities kind of hedge to an indicator of global worldwide recession, which is what it's doing this morning. 50% drop in the price of oil from its $147 a barrel peak in July. Joining us to explain all this is Javier Blas, who's a commodities correspondent for the Financial Times. He joins us from London once again. Javier, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
It seems like every time we speak, oil as an investment vehicle has been transformed dramatically. It's now trading at almost $70 a barrel. First of all, what's driving this?
It's as you were well pointing, is the fact that the world economy is slowing down in a dramatic way. About a year ago, when the credit crunch started, most of the investors in oil thought that it was a U.S. problem, that it was not even to affect maybe Europe or Japan, and of course not China and other emerging economies. That view has changed, and now the view is that we are not longer suffering a U.S. problem and a financial problem, but more a global economic crisis. Demand is very low, and is low not only in the U.S. but also here in Europe, Japan, and particularly in the last few weeks also in China.
And the energy complex is an indication that if demand for energy is down, then that means growth is probably being put aside. Talk for a minute about the similar drop-off in copper prices, which is another real indicator of governments and economies' willingness to spend on construction.
I think you are absolutely right. Copper is trading at a 34 months low. And copper is the base metal that is more closely related to industrial activity. We use copper for plumbing in new buildings, but we use also copper for cars, for new washing machines, for air conditioning equipment. So copper is basically a sense of how much we are building, not only real estate, but also industrial equipment. And when you see copper tanking in the way we are watching it right now in the London Metal Exchange, it's a good indicator that industrial demand is down. If you look also at the cost of shipping goods and commodities from one place to another, we see that cost have dropped 50% in the last 2 weeks. And that's also an indication that nothing is moving. Iron ore from Brazil is not moving to China. U.S. containers from Los Angeles are not moving either to China. Europe is not trading with the U.S. So you have a clear indication that the demand for commodities is slowing down in a very dramatic way.
Well, then my final question to you, and quickly before we have to go, how do you even begin to assess what the bottom is here and maybe start looking at some of these indicators as a suggestion that the economies are maybe slowly coming back?
I think that the bottom is where we begin to see prices approaching what is the production cost. When we see that a mine is selling copper below what it costs to get the copper out of the ground, when we see that oil prices have fallen below what it's the cost of production in Canada, and we in some commodities are approaching very fast those levels, and probably that will be the indication that we have reached the bottom.
Great way to look. Javier Blas, commodities correspondent for the Financial Times in London, watching the commodities and the declining price of oil. Thanks, Javier.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, October 16th. Femi Okay has just joined us with some headlines. Femi.
Hello there. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. U.S. markets are up a little bit. The Dow and the S&P have gained around about 1%. And this is in the wake of a slightly down day for European markets and an incredibly gloomy day for Asian markets. Japan's Nikkei was down 11.4%. Financial issues played a big role in last night's final presidential debate. John McCain and Barack Obama are now back on the campaign trail after clashing on taxes, healthcare, abortion and education. Caribbeans are cleaning up after Hurricane Omar. The Category 3 storm didn't do too much damage as it passed through the Virgin Islands overnight. It's now headed on a rather unusual northeastern path, well clear of the US coast. Firefighters in California are halfway there. A 13,000-acre fire in the San Fernando Valley is about 50% contained. Winds have eased, giving firefighters hope that they can actually beat the fire. And finally, to sports, where the Philadelphia Phillies are headed to the World Series. They beat the LA Dodgers last night to win the National League title. Buenos de Panto, Adora. They're waiting for the winner of the American League Championship. Game 5 takes place tonight, not far from you, John, in Boston. Are you going?
That's correct. Oh, yeah, yeah. I've got box seats at Fenway, sure.
Yeah, really? I'll watch just for that.
To sell my children to get that.
They're cute. You'll get enough for a ticket.
No. Okay.
Oh, they're probably listening. Didn't mean that, children. The Red Sox are trailing the Tampa Bay Rays 3-1. And that's a look at your news.
Great, Femi.
Thank you so much.
You're
welcome.
And we're asking you, what are your thoughts on the presidential debates or on the candidates? Have you picked one? What do you think about the choices you have before you? Naomi writes on our website, she says, pity nobody advised Mr. McCain, she's talking about last night in the presidential debates, that it may be unwise to call on plumbers to fix political problems. So there's Naomi's thought. Thank you. We want to hear from you at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. John?
Thought about Joe the plumber. Also on our website, there's an extended interview with the fascinating Adam Skaggs, who you talked to earlier. He's from the Brennan Center for Justice on election voting registration rolls and people being purged from those rolls inappropriately. So I'm up here in Boston at WGBH with Benjamin Mako Hill, who is a fellow at the Center for Future Civic Media at MIT. Now, you're an open source kind of guy, right, Mako?
That's true. Open source, free software.
Right, free software and free sort of exchange of information using digital platforms, right?
Absolutely.
Well, the military experienced both the pitfalls and the joys of that during the beginnings of the 2003 Iraq War, when soldiers were blogging from their tanks and sending pictures and videos to all kinds of platforms all around the world to share their experiences with people on the outside and to perhaps protest army policies and things. And it was all very exciting until the Abu Ghraib scandal, when, of course, some of the pictures and images from that created an enormous PR problem for the military. You know, when the users get control of the technology, the really interesting stuff starts to happen. Is that your experience?
That's absolutely my experience. It's when you move to sort of independent production, when you allow people to sort of produce and communicate on their own, then you get some really exciting things happening.
Exciting and in many ways unforeseen consequences. Joining us now is Mike Leibowitz, who is an attorney with Greenberg and Lieberman, who specializes in military free speech and works with the National Guard. Mike, the military, it's fair to say, has been scrambling to keep up with the implications of technologically savvy soldiers using the electronic media to get their stories and messages out. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. That's completely fair to say. You hit it right on the head with Abu Ghraib really caused a panic with the military. And if you look at Vietnam era, letters was their main, you know, source of communication from the soldiers. And now you have digital cameras on the battlefield, you have YouTube, you have blogs, you have emails, and the soldiers are definitely, you know, very engaged in the technology much quicker than the Army can adapt to what they're doing.
Well, it's hard to overstate the transformation that's taken place here. I mean, the prototype for the military blog is Thucydides, who was writing about the Peloponnesian War decades after it happened, if I'm not mistaken. Now it's instantaneous information from the battlefield. What steps has the military taken to try to control what's going on?
Well, what the military has done is that they issue what's called directives in the military, and that basically is to a little bit of bans, a little bit of rules here and there, so to speak. For example, last year they said you're not allowed to blog on certain ways. And the justification is that it's taken up the bandwidth, and I've served in Iraq, and I can tell you that bandwidth is an issue. However, the problem is that it becomes very subjective because they don't give clear guidance to the military commander, so everybody has their own version of what exactly a blog is. You mentioned, you know, the more intellectual type of blog, but also blogs, one could say that it's a posting on Facebook or MySpace. It could be is it your own web page when you're writing things? You can write an email to people and CC a number of other people.
And it's the full range of stuff. It's everything from look at what my awesome tank did, dudes, to this is my critique of General Petraeus, correct?
It is. It's exactly it. And what a lot of people don't realize, and here's part of the panic with the military, is that oftentimes someone will just take it with no political motivation at all to saying, hey, look how cool Iraq was. Look at my tank. But they also might be giving away tactical, secrets that most people wouldn't realize they were giving away. But the bottom line is the reason why the military is always about these blogs and all this online technology is mostly because of established rules that the military is trying to adapt to the new technology, meaning that you have the basically the technology is has adapted so much now that people are trying to people are afraid they're going to associate the military with the soldier, and the soldier is going to be speaking on behalf of the military, if that makes sense.
Well, it certainly changed the character of what's going on. When you hear what Mr. Leibowitz is talking about here, does it concern you, Mako? Does it say ring alarm bells in terms of open source and freedom of speech?
Well, I mean, a little bit. I mean, I think that making distinctions based on the technology, I think that's something that's an interesting idea, right? Because, of course, you can actually blog by sending an email as well, right? In the sense, it seems what's problematic is the idea that people will disclose certain types of information, but it sounds like the type of regulation isn't necessarily falling along those same lines. It's actually more against the technology
and you're actually making a really important point, Mako, which is why I was wondering as I'm listening to you, Mike, why were military officials so taken off guard? I mean, I can remember being in Baghdad just a few days after the Marines went in, and I was really struck by all of the digital cameras. There were so many people who were taking notes and getting on computers as soon as they can. It was so contemporaneous what they were experiencing and how they were describing it to their friends and family, and it was just happening all around you.
Yeah, that's I served in Iraq in 2005, 2006, and just about everybody had a digital camera.
Right.
And now they have phone banks, and they have email banks, and you have free access to the computer, which includes YouTube. I have clients who are literally right now smuggling YouTube videos home so that people back home can post the videos online.
I did a profile of a person who actually smuggled in an entire setup to do a satellite, full spectrum broadband system for all of Mosul. And basically set up his own way of exchanging video using technology that he brought in, through his own sort of devices. I guess, the question really becomes, Mike, is the military trading the morale benefit of people having all this technology with a sort of another issue of keeping the PR message consistent?
That's an excellent question. And to the military's credit, they are trying to balance that. The issue comes into play because, as a soldier in Iraq, when I was there, you would get used to the email. You get used to the, kind of the freedom of the technology. And if they pull it away too harshly, it is going to affect morale because the majority of the soldiers are using it for regular communications. And if you look at also from my experience with a lot of my clients, a lot of people are actually putting together some of these videos for legitimate whistleblower reasons.
Oh, and that's important to note. Mike Leibowitz, attorney with Greenberg and Lieberman, who specializes in military free speech, spoke to us from Washington. Also, thanks all hour to Mako Hill, fellow at MIT Center for Future Civic Media right here in Boston. Thanks.
Thanks, Mako. We're always on at The Takeaway. And get this, John, we got a question from a listener. Listen.
Hi, this is Jim in Cleveland. I heard that Joe Merzelbacher is not registered to vote. Can anybody confirm that?
He's referring to Joe the Plumber, whom John McCain spoke about at last night's presidential debate. And we did a little research, and according to the Toledo Blade, he lives in Toledo, Joe the Plumber has registered as a Republican and did vote in the primaries this year. So we want to hear from you. Questions, thoughts, ideas last night about the final debate between John McCain and Barack Obama. Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Here's your takeaway.
The odds of Mickey Mouse showing up at the poll and casting a vote are pretty low in this country.
That's Adam Skaggs, lawyer at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law. We have an extended interview with him on our website, so go to thetakeaway.org. And we talked to him earlier. Interesting, right? I'm Adora Udoji. You're listening to...
I'm John Hockenberg. This is
there.
The Takeaway.
I thought you left me.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.